Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan. Thanks so much for joining us. Here we are, post-celebration, but 10-plus years of doing this radio program. Been interviewing for, oh man, I can't believe, nearly 40 years. Really excited about today's program. A reminder that we do come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m., 7 p.m., and Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We do stream live at richarddugan.com. We also archive these programs, pardon me, at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page, and we also link to our guest. We'll be giving you that website so that you can get more information about what our guest has to share with us today, and we're very excited about the program today because we're going to be talking with a very experienced woman who is, I'm just going to go through some of these items. She's a shamanic guide. She weaves ancient wisdom into potent pathways for connecting with the heart of nature and of the cosmos. And she is the founder of Earth Caretakers. We could use a lot more of those folks, and a lifelong explorer of shamanic, animist, and I'll have to ask her about that one, and a meditative consciousness. And she lives in the San Francisco area. Meg Beeler, I thank you so much for joining us on the program, author of Weave the Heart of the Universe into Your Life, Aligning with a Cosmic Energy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's wonderful to be on your show.
You've got some great experience, great information to share with us as well. And, it's interesting. A day does not go by when we don't hear some kind of news. When I start thinking about our planet, our home, the place in which we live, and I start hearing about people who, for whatever reason, don't seem to think that it matters that we take care of this place. And I often think of I want to say to them, okay, if it doesn't matter, then I'm coming to your house and I'm going to go into any of your rooms and I'm just going to wreak havoc. I'm going to do some of the most despicable things in these rooms, soiling things and this and that, and the other, because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that we take care of the place in which we live. But I realize that's my frustrations speaking more than anything else because of where I live. I live, and you live, it sounds to me like you live in a somewhat of a rural area, at least away from, from city life, as it were.
Absolutely, yeah. I live in a very beautiful valley on the side of a mountain.
Yeah, and we live in the same fashion. We live up on a hill above Santa Barbara, facing the valley. And certainly we've been threatened by 10 fires. We've gone through 10 fires for the first time in 2017. We had to be evacuated for the first time. Mm. Fortunately, we came home to our home and everything was okay. Everything was intact. And I often tell people, I say, look, I view my place up on that hill and treat it as if I lived below myself. And that if I was going to, let's just say, do an oil change, I wouldn't let the oil just leak out onto the ground and flow onto and into the ground because I live down below. And what's that going to do to my living conditions and my water supply and my potential food supply and so on and so forth? And it's, I don't know about you, but it's just kind of frustrating from that standpoint. And I do want to talk about that. But I also want to talk about the aspect of nature, the universe, as it were, because nature encompasses the entire cosmos, the infinity of it, that it is, am I correct in my assessment, in my position that nature is our, if not one of the, it is our greatest teacher?
Well, we are nature, and nature is us. Our water on this planet comes from the stars. The breath you just took in is the same breath, same air that the dinosaurs and Genghis Khan breathed. So we're not separate from any of that. And we could say nature is our greatest teacher, certainly one of them. It's my greatest teacher. And many indigenous people believe that the signs and messages from nature and the spirit and all things was what informed their consciousness. The Aboriginal people say the mountain teaches the dreaming. And that's a very profound statement to me, because of course we have human teachers, and I've been very lucky to have many indigenous teachers, especially in the Andes, from whom I could learn a way of perceiving the world and being in the world and living in reciprocity. And I also listen to the trees and to the creatures and the mountain and the stones and the water to learn. So yes, it's certainly a beautiful teacher.
I also know, too, that it is possible for us as human beings, the supposed dominant species on the planet, to live in such a way that is in alignment with, in, shall we say, cooperation with the rest of nature. But unfortunately, somewhere along the way, we've sort of lost sight of that.
Certainly, it's not our fault. We live in a culture where the church separated nature and spirit, and then science came along and began to look at things in a more and more minute way to divide things up, so that, and it made sense for scientists to do that. You can't understand a molecule unless you look at the molecule and see how the molecule interacts with other molecules. But the effect of that in our culture and our thinking and our perception of the world is that we've learned to be separate. So we have to unlearn our separation.
Mm-hmm.
And, it takes some attention. I think we also have this gift of our ancestors who weren't so disconnected, whether it was our European ancestors who worked the land or our African ancestors who lived in the forest. Wherever our ancestors were from, remember we all come from 14 people. So we carry those memories in our genes, in our bodies, just like we carry, unfortunately, the trauma of our ancestors. And all of that affects how we enter into the world every day. And I wanted to address your frustration a little bit that you mentioned at the beginning, because it's something, of course, we all feel. And what I learned in the Andes, I was lucky enough about 20 years ago to be introduced to the Caro people, who lived from 15 to 17,000 feet in the very high mountains in a very severe and simple way. And they had no contact with Europeans because they went high up and the Spanish kind of didn't bother them. So their culture was intact until the mid-50s, so not that long ago. And their prophecies basically told them to come out of hiding and start interacting with us to try to help us survive as a human species and learn a different way. So what I learned and saw with them constantly was that they choose not to focus on the frustration, but they choose to let that go, to gift it back to the earth or the air or the water or the fire, and take in what they call sami, or very refined energy. And because they live in the mountains where there's, other than the storms of nature, it's beautiful and calm and there's not a lot of dissonance, a kind of natural thing to flow. But how I've taken that into my life is that every day I can let go of the density that's all around me, the density of news and of people's frustration and their grief when their family members are suffering from cancer and so on, any of that I can choose to let that go and reconnect myself with that more refined energy. And that gives me the courage and the grace and the fluidity to keep hold of a vision of a more beautiful world. And that's the vision that I think will, if anything will help us survive, it's that. And how do I feed that beautiful world?
We've talked an awful lot on this program about sound and vibration and its importance in our lives for healing as well as for, you know, centering and so forth. Can you talk to us from, I don't know if it would necessarily be specifically a shamanic perspective, but from yours, about the rhythm of the planet?
That's a wonderful question. Well, let's start on a smaller scale.
Okay.
And talk about the rhythm of two people. There's a wonderful practice that I learned years ago where you sit close to somebody, and when the other person breathes out, you breathe in. And so you're attending to their breath and yours, and you're trying to match the rhythm. And it's very interesting to do and very powerful, because when you focus on that, whatever other stuff was going on just kind of disappears, and you become, you flow into this beautiful rhythm with people. It's a great thing for couples to do, for example. And you can even do it when you're, the person you're kind of at odds with is, they're not doing it with you, but you can do that yourself to bring yourself into the rhythm. So in the same way, the more we connect with the tree in the park or the stream near our house or the ocean and open ourselves, it's a kind of opening in silence. I mean, we all experience this when we're out in nature. If we are still, there's a whole lot going on. And the longer we're still and paying attention, it's like our feelers kind of spread out from our body and start connecting with whatever is around us. And that's how we can get in rhythm with nature. So the flip side of that, of course, is we've just experienced on this planet very intense fires and floods and hurricanes. And it's a challenge to be in the rhythm of a hurricane, a huge challenge. And not, I mean, it's not something I recommend for people if they're not very experienced. But what shamans have always done, what healers have always done, is bring themselves into balance so the surrounding place can come into balance. There's very old stories about the rainmaker who comes to the village that's suffering drought, and he goes into a hut and says, please bring me food and leave me alone. And so the villagers bring him food every day, and nothing happens. And they're like, they're desperate because they've tried everything else, and they've hired this rainmaker from far away. So finally, after a few days, he walks out of the hut. And it starts raining, and they say, oh, thank you for bringing us rain. And he says, I didn't bring you rain. This village was out of balance, and I had to come into balance myself so the village could come into balance so that the rain would come. And that's a wonderful metaphor for all of us. It's a practice I've been doing a lot this summer, because I also live in an area of potential fire. And so every time there's a hot wind, I stop. Literally, I stop whatever I'm doing. And I try to be as grounded and as aligned as I can, so that to kind of give a message to the wind, you know. And it's a very mysterious thing to do, but it feels really powerful. And it's in the moment, it's the only thing I can do other than, you know, being physically prepared. So back to sound and vibration. Everything has sounds, everything has vibrations. And in my path, I'm not so interested in, say, with crystal bowls, people will say, well, this bowl does this and this bowl does that. You know, it affects your heart or your lungs or whatever, or your different chakras. For me, it's more spontaneous. But for example, when I tone, because I got to learn Mongolian overtone chanting a long time ago, the vibrations are in my body, and it affects my body, and different vowels affect my body in different ways. So if you love vibration and sound, it's fabulous to play with that. And that's one of the things in my book that I really try to emphasize. I give lots of different kinds of practices and try to address all the ways that you can align yourself with cosmic energy, because there's not just one way.
Yeah, and that's something that I remember years ago dealing with the position that was taken, especially by the church, is there's only one way. There's only one way. And I thought, wait a minute, but I can eat and drink and surround myself with a myriad of different foods, drinks, and peoples. I can go in so many different directions from a career standpoint. I could live pretty much anywhere I want on the planet. And I went down this laundry list of things that I could do and be and so forth. And there's only one way spiritually. That didn't make sense to me at all.
Well, that's a power thing.
Yeah.
I mean, we have somebody in the White House who thinks that way.
Yeah.
There's only one way and it's his way.
Yeah. By
it's
the way,
not working out so well, but
no. And then the other thing too, I have not heard this yet. My observations, and this is, I hope, a fairly objective observation, is that the tactic that is being used and has been used since the 15th or 16th of June 2015 is divide and conquer. If you divide the population and the more you splinter it, if they're not unified, then you get to conquer. And that's what's happening. And that does not last. I think we've seen that in civilizations past. That only can go on for so long, and the people eventually finally wake up and say, wait a minute, this isn't where we wanted to be. And eventually I think that will happen. And that's my dream, that we will return to that. You talk about something that I'm quite intrigued by, that I'd like for you to share with us. And that is this concept in your book of cosmovision. Define that for us and tell me how you came to that.
Well, I didn't make up that word.
Okay.
People in the Andes use, I mean, that's a translation, but that word describes the worldview and the vision of the cosmos and how we fit into it of the people in the Andes. And across the Andes, mostly focused in Peru now, but in lesser degrees in Ecuador and Bolivia, in some parts of Bolivia, it's an animist worldview. You wanted to know about that, so I'll mention that.
Yeah,
animist means the belief and perception that everything is alive. We can call it the spirit of a tree, or the energy of a tree, or the beingness of a tree, or the consciousness of a tree. Whatever word you use, the understanding is that that tree is a live being with whom we can interact, and with whom we do interact, at least if we are conscious about it. The same with a stone. Now, it's harder. I mean, I don't think anybody listening would disagree that trees are alive. Stones are alive. Stones carry messages. You can listen to a stone and hear things from it. Now, that's pretty amazing, because in our culture, we call them rocks, and rocks are dead objects.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Andes, the stones are alive, the water is alive, everything is alive. And so your relationship, your way of being in the world is being in relationship with everything. So you get up in the morning and you greet the sun. You cross a mountain pass and you leave an offering. You do a ceremony and you offer what's called kintus, three coca leaves, to the other people. And you offer them to the cosmos, to the stars and the planet and the entire universe. The litany can go on for a long time. But you're doing that with real conviction, because you know in this cosmovision that you're connected, and you have to be reciprocal in order to survive. So the choice point, getting back to the divide and conquer business, the choice point for each of us as individuals is to see where we're going to put our energy. Mm-hmm. Am I going to put my energy into being frustrated and mad and angry? Am I going to put my energy into trying to connect with my essence and be my light bit, be a light being, be a loving person, that kind of thing? And that choice happens every minute. And I had a very big lesson. It was at the beginning of the first Iraq War, which was sometime in the 90s. I can't quite remember.
Early
when
90s,
that.
It was 91.
With George Bush. Mm-hmm. And I was in a meditation group at that point that met twice a week, and just a small group of women. And during that time, I realized that many of my friends, my progressive friends, and me included, had always been angry. And I started thinking about that, and I started talking to people about that. And my friends would say, well, I fuel my protest with anger. And I really stepped back from that and thought, I don't want to do that anymore, because, you know, the old saying about how you act creates what happens. Mm-hmm. Being angry and it feeds the divide and conquer. It feeds the otherness. It feeds also our own egoic sense of we're good and we're right and the other people are stupid.
Yeah.
But when we feed that, we're feeding the divide and conquer. So how do we step back and feed the connection? And connection is a really important word to me, because every time I feel connected with another person or with something in nature, my heart fills. And it's easier for me to do it again and again and again. And I like being connected. I did not enjoy growing up being an isolated child. Mm. And most of us didn't. So nature was the place where I could, nature was the safe place for me. The people weren't so great. So I just naturally connected with nature. And then as an adult, I thought, okay, how can I do this? How can I integrate it into my life? So this new book, Weave the Heart of the Universe into Your Life, is really a transformational guide for people to figure out how to step more into connection. And you know what's really remarkable? When you feel connected with your environment, you don't feel alone anymore. Mm. You don't have that kind of isolation that everybody in this culture suffers from so much.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know that until it happened to me, and I thought, I'm fine here. I might not have a lot of human friends, but I have a lot of other friends, so the Cosmovision is a way of seeing, perceiving differently, and it has some. It's what I call the four pillars of perception that have to do with intent. What am I choosing to do? Mm-hmm. Reciprocity, and resonance. We were talking about alignment and resonance before. Mm-hmm. And the fourth thing is receptivity. So that's pretty hard for most of us. We're really good at giving and not so good at receiving. But that receptivity, like I was talking about, when you go in nature and you just sit by the stream and you're silent and you're not looking at your cell phone and you're just watching the water or listening to the birds, that's when you become receptive to this larger world that can feed you and nurture you and teach you all kinds of things.
Yeah, it's one of the other perceptions that I have, too, in regard to what you're talking about. When I think about our world, this planet, and our civilizations, and the dualism that we perceive and seem to live under when we're not in our in that space that you're talking about, but we're in our ego and, you know, we're looking at those different, okay, well, divide and conquer and, you know, and the frustrations and so forth. Then I start taking a look at what's going on in the universe. I take a look at what astronomers show us about the movement of things and how things are hurtling through space at incredible rates of speed, and they crash into one another. And we, human beings, would look at that, oh my gosh, what utter destruction, and so forth. And yet, from the universe perspective, it's just that's just the universe being the universe. That's the way it happens. There's no judgment on it. There is no evaluation as to whether it was right or wrong, good or bad. It just is. And so when I look at that macro view, and then I bring that down to more of a micro view of where I'm at, and I say, our existence on this planet is less than a puff of smoke and about as tangible. And in 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 years from now, nobody's going to know, let alone care, about what has been going on in the linear timeline of just these past three, let alone three decades, 300 years, or 3,000 years of human history. It just, and it's like, wow, it just doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. Now, that doesn't mean that you and I, hopefully being on somewhat of the same wavelength here, don't want to assist others in coming to this same space of a new perception, if you will, that universal perception again. And we, you know, we're going to continue talking about weaving the heart of the universe into your life, the title of your book, and a great concept. But I think that's kind of when we change that perspective, that's what we want to do. We want to help others to reach that same perspective, to realize that, yes, we do have to go to work and we do have to do these things, but we don't have to get sucked into and wrapped up in all of this other stuff that, and again, really doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an interesting, what makes me think of is that there's the puff of smoke, and then there's your human life and my human life with all these amazing experiences and friends and places you've lived that's very substantive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's both of them exist concurrently. And that's the world of non-dualism, which is a whole kind of teaching, focuses on how to bring both those things together in a non-egoic state. And my particular pathway with that is that the more I have experienced being connected with nature and the cosmos, in both physical ways, spiritual ways, energetic ways, and mystical ways, the more I've experienced those connections, the less I have felt my quote self. It's as if the ego dissipates, not in a bad way, but in that way that you're describing as not important. I'm here, I'm in my body, I'm very aware, and I'm just a puff of smoke at the same time. And it's, you know, people spend many, many words talking about this, and I sort of prefer to experience it. I mean, that's my bent is when you experience things, you don't have to have a lot of intellectual discussion about it. You just do it, and then you can live your life in a different way.
Exactly. Exactly. We're talking with Meg Beeler. She's the author of Weave the Heart of the Universe into Your Life, Aligning with Cosmic Energy. We will continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Please, we would really appreciate it if you stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Meg Beeler, and she is the author of her latest work, Weaving the Heart of the Universe into Your Life, Aligning with cosmic energy. Let's talk about that. Cosmic energy. I mean, yes. we've you know, maybe danced around it quite a bit. I happen to be a Reiki master, and I know that when I'm in my training and my teaching, I was told that the energy, I become a conduit for the energy to flow through me, and that I do not control what it will do, that it is up to you and the individual that I am sending it to through myself, who chooses what to do with that, I'll call it a tool, if you will, that energy from the universe, and so forth. Are we talking about that same kind of energy? Give us an overview, if you will.
Yes, absolutely. And that same principle applies in all shamanic work, that I can do my healing with you, and you have to be it's sort of like you have to be receptive. You have to be open to it. And if you get a healing and then 2 seconds later you flip back into your old story about everything is terrible in my life, that healing is probably not going to do very much or stay with you. But if you receive the healing and stay open to whatever energies are moving through you, as you've noticed as a Reiki master, change can happen. So the universe to me, and this is where my shamanic journeying practice has really fed the energy work from the Andes. The universe to me is a place of creation and destruction, just like you were talking about. It's also can be described as the void, empty but full. Anything is possible. And in connecting with that, what I experience is another way of getting out of ego. When I go and when I travel to the heart of the universe, I'm seeing a version of the creation and destruction, the black hole eating things and not spitting them out, and feeling that. And somehow that has helped me to be more accepting of the destruction that we've seen the last few weeks with the hurricanes, not accepting of the suffering people, because they didn't do anything to deserve it, you know, individually. And that's a whole conversation I don't even have an answer to. But to understand that there's forces, to see that there's forces way larger than us humans, and they are at work, and they are interacting, and they're going to keep on interacting in a destructive way until we get it. And a lot of us know that maybe we're not going to get it. I don't sit around and think about that, but my response to it is, okay, what can I do to keep the channels of consciousness open so that if this species meets its demise, some of our understanding can get carried into the universe for whoever else can pick up on it. And that's like, you know, you've heard of Buddhist monks who die and then they look for a young child who's been reborn as that person. And those young children will recognize objects, even though they had never met the Buddhist monk, and they'll know things that they have no way of knowing, because there's not only a belief that happens, but there's a strong thread of awareness that our consciousness survives our bodies. So what kind of consciousness are we going to have, and what are we doing with it, and what do we want to feed with it? That's always my questions.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in spite of, I think, a very fair statement that the people who have been devastated by this year's hurricanes, especially along our southern coast and, of course, the islands out to the east, and yet at the same time, from a more broader perspective, not only cosmologically but metaphysically, it isn't a question so much of whether or not they deserved it, as much as it was an and this is just from what I have has been shared with me on this program in particular, as well as other research I've done, that they chose those experiences. It's not a question of blame. Again, the whole dualism thing. It's a question of, I signed a contract that said I was going to go through some of these experiences. And there's a program, a comedy on television now that loves to use this one quote. It's not the something I'll paraphrase. It's not the events of one's life that defines one. It's how one handles those events, or how one faces them, if you will. And so these are the events that individuals have, you know, again, from a metaphysical perspective, have sort of chosen to go through. And even that's a hard one to get people to understand, let alone accept, because it's like, well, who would choose that? Well,
right.
Yeah.
I used to feel the same way when, you know, I guess it was in the 70s, I can't remember. When you know, I'd have a bad cold and people would say, oh, well, you chose that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I was in a personal growth program.
I was not receptive to that.
Well, there was a statement made in a personal growth program that I went to. My first wife, totally blind, needed somebody to guide her through. And so I said, okay, I won't participate, but I'll be there to be your guide dog, so to speak. And the next thing I know, you know, I can't be in the room and not be involved. That was a prerequisite. And that at one point early on the first day, first evening, they said, and if you are struggling with whether or not you really want to be here, let me just set your mind at ease, which it didn't, by the way. If you didn't want to be here, you wouldn't be. You'd be somewhere else. But you're here, so that must mean you want to be here. So be here. And so wherever we find ourselves, without being too humorous and flippant, wherever you are, that's where you are, because that's where you've chosen to be, to do the things that you've chosen to do, to experience the things you've chosen to experience. And I think that I don't know if that can help people at all when they're going through the various challenges. For example, I see, and I was born and raised in Arizona, so I sort of relate. I look at and listen to the words of Senator John McCain, for example, who's suffering with I don't know if he's in stage 2, 3, or 4 of his cancer. But the man has an attitude of, hey, you know, I've lived a good life, and I've done some incredible things, and I've been able to serve. Which I think
he continues to serve in the choices he's making.
In the choices, yeah. And you and I, we have chosen our particular venue of service, we hope that we can continue to do it for a long time to come, to hopefully inspire others to do the same, because the work that you and others like you do is just, it's very important. I don't know if you perceive it this way. I've heard this statement about especially the monastic life, the various cloisters around the world of various faiths and philosophies who are praying, who are chanting, who are doing all of these things in these cloistered situations, as well as individuals throughout the planet in urban and rural areas. They're like the glue that's holding everything together right now. And that if they all stopped, everything would fall apart. I mean, even if you think things are bad now, if they stopped, things would really get crazy.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned them, because that's one of the things I do is connect into the field of energy that all those meditators and people praying and people doing healing are creating. And I do this partly because some years ago I was with one of my Andean teachers, and he told us to go meditate, and I was sitting on this rock looking out to the ocean, and I had a profound sense that all 9 billion people in the world were meditating together. It was very visceral. And I came out of that, and I thought, whoa, we don't have 9 billion people yet. So maybe that will happen, and how can I feed that? And so it inspires me to do that, because I know that if I connect my energy to all those other people, it makes the field bigger and stronger. And, you know, my teacher, Sandra Ingerman, years ago started this idea of the full moon web of light. On the night of the full moon, you see yourself connected to everybody else through the web. And mm-hmm. and it's a beautiful way to honor the full moon and to honor the what you say is the glue. And it helps those kinds of actions help us as individuals stay focused on serving the planet and serving each other and having courage and having fluidity. The courage that we're called to pull forth these days is enormous. And every spiritual teacher I know is having to spend more and more time just coming back into balance every day. But, you know, years ago I heard that the Dalai Lama said he gets up at 3 a.m. and meditates, you know, before he has his daily schedule for like 4 hours. And that's been a marker for me. If he has to meditate 4 hours a day, then I could certainly meditate 4 hours a day. I mean, I don't often do that, but it tells you what a true, beautiful spiritual leader does to hold the space that he does. I mean, he has this incredible, I don't know if you've ever been with him, but he has this charming, sweet laughter and is just a dear person, even with all his wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've actually heard him laugh, and it's quite infectious and very playful in that respect, and that's very cool. It really is. We're talking.
I wanted to tell you one more thought about
please
your quote about it's how you handle events. A couple of things actually. One is I think it was somebody in Puerto Rico. I can't quite remember, but one of the hurricane survivors said, "We'll get through this." And I thought, that is an attitude that is really important. It's just what you're saying. I use a different phrase myself, which is where your attention goes, your energy flows.
Mm.
So if your attention goes to fear, your energy, your neurons, everything in your body goes to fear. If your attention goes to fluidity of the river, that's where your energy goes, and so on. And that's it's a kind of motto I use for myself and remind myself, because it helps me see what choices to make. And I had one more little funny story about how you handle events. My mom was extremely narcissistic. I mean, she had a lot of wonderful qualities, but she was very hard to grow up with. And one time, not that long ago, I was walking on Mount Diablo, one of the sacred mountains in the Bay Area, and the mountain where I, in the Andes, you'd say it was my birth mountain, because it's where I grew up, where I was close to. And I'm walking along, and the mountain says to me all of a sudden, "You got your mother so you could meet me."
Hmm.
And my whole life became understandable.
Mm. The path that we happen to find ourselves on is as a result of those people and situations that we've gone through.
Yes.
and we did make it through those events, as that other quote that you gave us says. And for me, I've been very fortunate, I suppose, and that's certainly a dualistic judgment on my part, that I haven't suffered through, I personally, as an individual, have not suffered through any major calamities or catastrophes. Now, my first wife did, my second wife, my siblings, several have gone through certain things, but I'm not saying I by any means I've made all the right choices. I live under a lucky star or anything. I've always felt that I've been at the right place at the right time. And I've tried to listen to that intuitive voice, that little voice inside. I went through a program where they had us write down on a big rectangular piece of white construction paper with a black Sharpie some statement that we felt was important. And for whatever reason, my intuition was part of that. And so I wrote down in cursive, I will listen to, and then I changed to block, big block printing, and follow the promptings of my friend. That's how I referred to my intuition. And I joke with people. I say, you know, if you're going to listen, then you need to follow. Because if you're not going to follow, why bother listening? You know.
Right. Yeah. In the shamanic world, when you go and ask a question, ask for a prescription for how to deal with something, and you'll get a prescription. Very early on, when I was learning shamanic journeying, I had asked a question. I'd gotten something, and I went back a couple weeks later and essentially asked the same question. And my power animals were like, we told you what to do. What is your problem?
That's good.
It was a very important lesson in just what you're saying.
Well, I know that especially when it comes with animals, and we have chickens, we have six cats, they're all indoor, we have two dogs. And one of the big lessons that we have learned over the years, and I in particular, because I didn't grow up with pets. My folks just didn't. I guess they figured six kids was enough animals in the house, as it were. And one of the things that we've picked up on over the years is when one of the animals is doing something, and it doesn't matter. You could list whatever it is that they're doing. If the cats are peeing on the bed, or if the dogs are tearing up the carpet in the house, or maybe they're digging holes in the backyard, there's a reason. And it's not your job, or my job, I should say, it's not my job to keep them from doing this. My job is to try to understand why they are doing it. They're not at fault. To me, it goes back to the whole argument of dualism versus unity and the oneness. They've done nothing wrong. They're only doing what they know to do, let's just say, to get my attention. And it's kind of like a game. I've got to play the game to try to figure out what it is, why they're doing what they're doing. And hopefully I can then in turn give them what they are asking for through this process, so that maybe they'll stop doing it. Now, that doesn't always work. I know, for example, you have a dog in the backyard and he's tearing stuff up, he's bored. He doesn't have anything to do. So I need to give him something to do, and so forth. So I think
that's a great metaphor for hurricanes.
Yeah.
Nature is giving us messages with hurricanes and floods and fires. And it's hard for us to understand, but that's the question. What is the meaning of this? And when you look at the whole of it, the intensity of storms, the intensity of destruction, the frequency, like you said, you have 10 fires in Santa Barbara this year. Knock on wood, we haven't had any where I live. But there is a message in that, and you're exactly right. Our job is to listen and figure out what we can do to come back, bring it back into balance.
Yeah.
So maybe that means getting rid of gasoline-powered cars. Maybe that means signing the Paris Climate Agreement. Maybe it means something more spiritual for an individual. Maybe it means all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all a part of this world. And my neighbors or my nephews throwing, you know, not recycling, contributes to the whole thing. And the same time, we all do the best we can.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's one of the sad things to me. My parents lost their house in a fire, and my husband's very dear friends lost their house in a fire. Both of them were such hot fires that everything burned to the ground. And it was not even a refrigerator left. So we watched people very close to us responding to that, how they handle the event, and they handled it in different ways. And we've watched the individual suffering that people have when catastrophe hits. And one of my concerns, I don't know what to do about it, but one of my concerns is that with all these catastrophes, not only do the rest of us get kind of inured to it and not want to think about it anymore, but all these people are having to focus on survival.
Yeah.
Where do I get water on the mm-hmm. island? What am I going to build with when there's nothing left? How do I find shade when the trees have all been stripped of all their vegetation? I mean, these are serious day-to-day questions. And when you're in that survival mode, you don't have, mostly, you don't have energy or attention to do anything else. So, I don't know where I was going with that, but that's that's what I see, and it concerns me because whether it's somebody working with their cancer or working with the effects of the hurricane, their attention is totally going to their personal issue, and that means less of us holding the glue of the more beautiful world, holding the glue of being a part of cosmic energy and using that. I guess the other piece I want to say is my personal energy is so sustained and made stronger by being connected with nature. Mm-hmm. Before I used to, I just used to feel I would do a lot of stuff, but I felt exhausted all the time. Now I know if I'm feeling exhausted, I go out and sit with a tree, or I do some Qigong for 5 minutes, or I do something to reconnect myself and let go. And I haven't talked about that. One of the really important parts of the book, Weave the Heart of the Universe into Your Life, is a practice of releasing density, opening to what's around you, taking in the more refined energy, and connecting. And mm-hmm. that practice in many, many, I have 84 practices in this book for, you don't have to do all of them, but you take the ones that appeal to you.
Right.
Those practices are a way of very simply, step by step, checking out whether it's possible to shift your attention and shift your energy and create a new story for yourself, all of those things, and be in alignment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Meg, I want to thank you, Meg Beeler, for joining us on the program. And in the last few minutes we've got, I want to first of all extend to you an invitation. Should you find yourself hopefully out of the heat and down in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation, although we may not wait that long because you've got some great information to share with us. But that invitation is open to you. We'd love to have you in studio.
Thank you, Richard. That's a very nice invitation.
And a reminder
and
to
I have cousins who live there, so maybe I will see you.
Oh, fantastic. MegBeeler.com, by the way, is the website, MegBeeler.com. And we encourage you to pick up a copy of Weave the Heart of the Universe into Your Life, Aligning with Cosmic Energy. And I have three final questions for you as we wrap up the program. And again, thank you so much for sharing so much time with us. First of all, who is Meg Beeler?
I'd say she's a vessel for love and light and exploring consciousness.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
To open people's hearts, to help them open their hearts and feel connected in this beautiful world we live in, with each other, with the planet, with the universe.
And what is your life's purpose?
To serve the planet and all the creatures on it.
Meg Beeler, thank you again for joining us on the program. Again, the title of the book, Weave the Heart of the Universe into Your Life, Aligning with Cosmic Energy. We greatly appreciate the time and the sharing here on the program today. And we, again, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's been a great pleasure to converse with you, and I hope we have another chance. And thank you, listeners, for hanging in there.
And I know that we will. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lala.